Hey guys, welcome to episode 240 of the True Crime Couple podcast. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
We hope you're doing well and you're ready for another episode. We are now officially in the month of September, so we are fast approaching our spooky season. So please remember to send your listener stories to truecrimecouple@gmail.com. I almost forgot our email for a second. We can't wait to hear what you guys bring us this year because every year it is incredible and I'm truly terrified reading them. So I'm excited to do that again.
Don't forget me. I love them a lot.
John is pretty obsessed.
Last year we had one where it was awesome. It was like where she kept doing like the jog around the lake and there was that person there.
Yes.
Remember that one? Mm-hmm. That one was good.
I think it was a park.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Park. But I think, wasn't there like a body of water or something near it or something?
Yes, because there was a bridge.
You're right. Exactly. Yeah. That one was really good.
It's coming back to me now.
It's all coming back to me now, Celine Dion. Anyway, but yeah, I thought that one was good. So that's like an honorable mention from last year. I really enjoyed that one. So,
and I the one that with like the whispering in the ear with the baby, that I think about that every time I put Ryan down to sleep. So just so you know.
That was good too. That was good too.
That's always in the back of my mind.
See, I think it's just like we just like them all. So
incredible. There's not a bad one. Like Stephen King says. There's no such thing as a bad horror movie. Like, there's no such thing as a bad paranormal story.
It's true, because it tickles the fancy of somebody, right? Mm-hmm.
So, also, if you're new to Patreon, stay tuned at the end of the episode, because we're going to give you a personal shout-out for joining. We couldn't do this without you, so we are eternally grateful for anything you could do for us. So we love talking to you guys at the end of every episode. So if that's you, please stay tuned. Okay. And I think that's the end of those things. So John, do you want to hear something crazy?
Of course.
In the 1980s, Monterey, California was a place of striking contrasts in its landscape, its image, and within its population. The beautiful ocean views, towering cliffs, and pristine blue waters of the Monterey Bay looked like something that could only exist on a postcard. But you should never let beauty fool you. The coastline and those lurking around it were dangerous. As the fishing industry that once defined Monterey had collapsed the decade before, the community found itself clinging to all that it had to keep any type of industry alive. And the one thing that it had a surplus of, that they would never run dry of, was beauty. And so the great shift began. Old canneries became gift shops. Hotels replaced industrial buildings. Restaurants began to cater to tourists. And the Monterey Bay Aquarium was built. The physical change eventually gave way to a social one, where lower-income families were driven out of the area due to the high prices more wealthy families were paying for vacation properties. And the transient population that once called the beach home were forced out by new town ordinances because it had to look good for the tourists. But change doesn't happen overnight, and neither do the secrets a community leaves behind. Sometimes they're simply buried beneath the surface, waiting to be uncovered.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
The late afternoon of September 2nd, 2015 was perfect for planting. A beautiful 71 degrees with cloudy skies, a landscaper's dream. And from where they were at 1165 3rd Street, they were just four blocks away from the coastline. So the breeze brought in the nice chill and soothing smells of the ocean. The plan for young Alec Reed was to plant fruit trees in the backyard of the two-bedroom bungalow property a few feet from their fence line on the left-hand side of the yard, so the colorful trees would be visible from the street. As he dug, he hit something hard. But what he had found was larger than a rock that he thought it would have been. And smoother, too. The object was brown and seemed to have some attachments coming off of it. As his brain tried to process what he had found, the only thing that he could come up with was a coconut. But why would a coconut be buried in the ground? And why was there green plastic covering parts of it? He moved the object with his shovel to get a better look at it. And when he did, the object turned on its side, and he saw the profile of a human skull.
Oh my God.
The eye socket, all of the teeth still intact, and hair still attached. Then it clicked for him all at once. It wasn't brown, it had just been covered in dirt. It wasn't a coconut, it had been the back of someone's skull. Someone had been buried face down in the backyard.
That's insane. At first, as you're telling, I'm like, why the hell would he think it's a coconut? But you know what?
It's because I understand of it. Like little, there was, because it had been underground for so long, it looked like tiny, like, you know, the hairs of a coconut. It looked exactly like that coming out of the skull.
And that's what my brain was also processing, you know, after like a little bit. That's terrifying.
Not what you would expect.
No.
Because think about it. If someone is living there and saying, oh, I want trees planted here, they're not going to say, uncover my grave site, you know?
Right. Well,
so the owner most likely doesn't even know, and the landscapers just happen to be planting a tree right there.
This is actually an insane interaction now. Think about it, right? Because if you are unaware, but somebody else discovers it, they can be like, is this guy, like, did he kill somebody and bury them?
Yeah.
And we're working for someone who can kill people.
Yeah. Or like, yeah, did this guy think he did it deep enough that we could plant a tree over it?
Yeah. I don't know if I'd feel comfortable. I'd probably have to leave.
Yeah. Well, at a loss of what to do, Alex ran to his boss. He was terrified and in a panic. The man calmed him down as best as he could. They didn't want to inform the owners. What if they knew it was there? What if, like we just said, they had done it? But then why would they hire them to dig there? Nothing made sense. But then again, being a landscaper in Monterey for many years taught him that rich people have a lot of secrets. So together and alone, the men called 911.
Good for them. I mean, just in case, right?
Yeah, you don't want to be next.
Exactly. You know, they might not have any involvement, but it's still good to call. So I'm glad they did that.
Yes. An officer from the Monterey Police Department arrived at the scene to confirm that, in fact, the landscaping team at the residence did, in fact, find human remains. The man was shocked to find that they had. And by the looks of the remains and the worn state of the green garbage bag that covered it, he could tell that whoever they may be, they had been there for a while. Detectives arrived and understood that what they had was the entire remains of a skeleton in the backyard of this property. And in order for it to be excavated properly, they would need to call in the assistance of the Monterey County Sheriff's Coroner's Division. From that point on, it was the Sheriff's Department that took responsibility for the recovery and identification of the body. A forensics team carefully excavated the area and slowly uncovered the grave of an adult female who had been buried along the fence line of the property, face down. A green plastic garbage bag covered the top half of her body. She had been wearing a beautiful knee-length dark red dress that had been all bunched up all the way to her neck. She had on a bra, but she was naked from the waist down. Although the clothing hung loosely around the skeletal remains, it did not mask the intentions of the person that had left the woman in that position. Humiliation, self-gratification, and sadism. As they slowly uncovered more and more of her body, the gravity of what they were uncovering hung over them. A victim that had long awaited justice had just been freed.
That's really sad. But you know what? It's also good, you know, because there's somebody that's been missing and a family that's probably seeking answers. You know, another thing, too, is they might find this body, but you never know. They could be that whole area could have more bodies. You don't know.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Sean, because I'll have more to reveal later.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Investigators quickly had been able to put the death of the person to be from over 30 years prior, which was good news for the homeowners who had bought the property in 1998. They were more shocked than the law enforcement officers working to reveal the body that she was there. They had never known that all along she had been right beneath their feet.
Also very scary and unsettling.
The community of Monterey was just as shocked to hear about the news of a body being unearthed in their neighbor's backyard as they were trying to put in some landscaping. And it would make sense that they would be shocked because it's jarring news. However, another reason would be that Monterey, California had a very low crime rate, and everyone who lived in the picturesque, wealthy neighborhood had always felt like crimes just didn't occur in their coastal town. But what they weren't taking into account was that if these remains were from over 30 years prior, she came from a very different Monterey, one that dealt with the economic struggles between the rich and the poor and the growing transient population that settled on the Monterey Peninsula. And with both of those factors came crime in its many forms. So there, this woman was a time capsule of a Monterey past, there to remind everyone of a time when their community was not the rich location that is always featured in movies or TV shows, as it was in 2015. And that became a part of the story as the media descended upon Third Street to report on the mystery in Monterey.
It's very interesting the way that you're wording this to us, because you're right. She is a time capsule, you know, and I think that based on that and how it used to be back then and how much it's different than now, kind of gives you some clues, though, because it's also like, you know, what she was wearing, things like that could all be clues as to how she wound up there.
Right.
If you really get into the nitty gritty of it.
And clues will be revealed as well.
Okay.
Because of this, the investigators knew the pressure would be on. But luckily, they had already uncovered useful information to help them identify their victim. Within her grave, someone had placed various personal items that must have belonged to her. There had been a silver ring with a green stone in the middle, and a purse. Within the purse, they found some makeup items, breath spray, and a calendar from 1982.
Oh my God. Okay.
Now, they most likely had the year of when this woman had been buried. Within the purse, there was one more important clue, a picture. The scratched and faded image was that of an African-American woman dressed to the nines. She wore a beautiful canary yellow dress and high heels as she sat on a couch of a similar color to her dress, and the same colored curtains behind her. A lot of the picture had been damaged by time, but luckily the portion of the picture that showed her face was still intact. Because the detectives had the year of 1982 to work with, they figured that the first thing that they should do was to take the picture of the woman and compare it to missing persons cases from that year. And again, they were in luck. It was almost like the hardest part of the investigation was over, finding the body. And now, once time had revealed her, she held all the clues that made everything fall into place quite quickly.
Yeah, it's almost like working a case, like, actually from backwards to front.
And she was like, just find me, and I'll tell you everything. And that's what was happening here.
Wow.
The investigators found a woman that they believed was the same woman they'd found in the picture that had been buried with their victim. The woman who had been reported missing was a mother of three, Sandra Steppen, or Sandra McGee, McGee being her maiden name and how she was reported missing. They quickly thumbed through the files from 1982, hoping that the detective or detectives that had investigated the case had preemptively retrieved dental records for comparison, in case their missing person had been a victim of a homicide. And they had.
Wow, they're just getting lucky at every step.
They are. The dental records that they found for Sandra Steppen were sent in for a comparison to that of the skull that had been found. And quickly, they were found to be an exact match.
There you go.
But before we get any further into this story, I want to take a break here and talk to you about the sponsor of today's show and a product we can't get enough of, Instant Hydration. Whether you're working out, spending time outdoors, traveling, or just trying to feel your best, hydration matters. Did you know hydration affects almost everything? Energy, focus, workouts, and even how you feel throughout the day. We've been enjoying our instant hydration mixes for over a month now, and we both cannot say how much we are feeling the difference. I have a lot more energy and focus through the day, which is important juggling school, the podcast, and our sweet baby girl. Everything helps when your day is jam-packed, and I've loved what instant hydration has been able to do for me, and it's enjoyable. I've also found that it's even improved my life when I'm not running all over the place, as I've definitely been sleeping better. Instant Hydration is a premium electrolyte drink mix designed to support hydration, energy, recovery, focus, and overall performance without sugar or unnecessary additives. Again, Instant Hydration contains zero sugar, no glucose spike, and no sugar crash involved. And what I love about Instant Hydration is that it's truly science made simple. The mix contains sodium to support hydration, fluid balance, energy, and focus. Potassium to support muscle function, electrolyte balance, and recovery. Magnesium to support cellular energy, relaxation, recovery, and sleep support. And finally, Aquamin, an ocean-sourced mineral complex containing calcium and trace minerals. For a better way to stay hydrated, go to instanthydration.com/TCC and use our promo code TCC for over 40% off your first subscription order. It's Instant Hydration's best offer available. That's instanthydration.com/TCC. Promo code TCC. Okay. Now let's get back to the show. So it was good that it had been relatively easy for the detectives to identify the body they had found. But now came the hard part, finding out what had happened to her. But before any of that, the county investigators had to notify the family of Sandra Steppen of what had happened to her. News that they had waited 32 years, 8 months, and 25 days to hear.
I mean, that is insane. Imagine waking up that morning, that family, any family member that has been, you know, wondering what's been going on with that.
And that's the day.
That's crazy.
Just a random day in 2015. At the time of their mother's disappearance, Sandra's children had been very young. Her twins, Gigi and Bridget, were 12, and her youngest daughter, Tammy, was only 7. They were now 44, and 39. Hearing what happened to their mother had different effects on them, just as her disappearance had. Once they were told about the discovery on 3rd Street, the women shared with them what they had known about their mother. Sandra, to the girls, was larger than life. They described her as this amazing, beautiful woman who lived her life to the fullest. They remembered that their mother loved to dance and sing, and that she would always be the first and last one on the dance floor. She made every day fun. Her laughs were big, her hugs were big, her love was big. They also said that Sandra was never the woman to have enemies, At least they didn't think so. They remembered everyone loving their vibrant mother. All the kids in the neighborhood also loved her, as she always let all the kids come over. She was like the neighborhood mom, and it made them feel special. After the detectives visited with the family, they promised to keep them up to date about the investigation as they parted ways. They next had to scour the massive missing persons report and find out what the police learned about Sandra and what headway they had made in their investigation into her disappearance back in 1982. Through the file, they learned that Sandra had met her husband Patrick while he was stationed in Fort Ord in Monterey, California. Their relationship was described as them being two very different people. While Sandra was an extrovert, Patrick was an introvert. However, there must have been a love between them at one point, as their relationship must not have been an easy one. After all, interracial marriages were not treated kindly by many narrow-minded people in 1969. Whether it was Southern California or Birmingham, Alabama, the couple would have felt the pressure. And if you know your history, it was only in 1967 that Loving versus Virginia was passed, which is going to allow for interracial marriage to occur.
Yeah, so it's not that far removed from that.
No. But at some point, they must have lost whatever that spark was. And they became, as described by those who knew them, two ships passing in the night. And after three children and 7 years of marriage, the couple chose to divorce in 1976. Once the couple separated, Patrick moved a few towns over, and the ex-couple co-parented very well. They were actually really friendly with each other, which made things very easy for them to communicate about their three children. The custody agreement they came to was a very odd one, in my opinion, and most likely would not have been allowed if it had been dictated by a court, but also to each their own, right? Whatever works for your family. But it was also easy for them, too, because they lived in the town, the same town, so they were able to send their children to school no matter whose home they were at. The agreement was that for 6 months out of the year, they would live with Sandra, and then for the other half of the year, they would live with Patrick. However, each weekend, the other was allowed visitation.
Okay. I mean, that's not too bad, I guess. I mean, like you said, definitely not something that would have been done through a court system, but sometimes, I don't know, maybe this is just me. Maybe this is me just being not trusting of our governmental bodies sometimes, but sometimes when you get them involved, it makes things worse. If this works for them, like you said, right, then that's what it's really all about, because only the family knows sometimes what's best. But, you know, it can go either way.
Right, and I'm assuming the decision that was made was based on stabilization. They didn't want constant movement, so I guess they thought this was going to create some sense of stability for the girls. However, this arrangement was actually hard on them. As they got older, the girls were able to communicate their feelings in clearer ways. And in the summer of 1982, when the twins were 12 and their younger sister was 7, the girls went to their mother with a proposal. They had grown tired of the back and forth and wanted even more consistency in their lives. So they asked if they could keep the rotating schedule, but just prolong the time with each parent to a year instead of every 6 months. Sandra and Patrick both agreed to the arrangement because it was what the girls wanted. But Sandra's family had told the detectives at the time that she had agreed to it because it was what they wanted, and she thought it would be better for them, but it broke her heart to be away from her daughters for so long. Yes, she got to see them on the weekends and spoke with them on the phone every other day, but she wanted to soak in every second she could with them. And being away from them all week for a whole year was really hard. So to distract herself from that alone time she was in for, and to help with the bills while she was at it, Sandra took on two roommates. The women all seemed to get along well and would go out with Sandra on occasion. But really, that was how Sandra was just passing the time until she got her year in the sun with her girls. But that made the detective sad as they read on, because they knew that that time for Sandra would never come. Not for her or her daughters. And you have to think, too, they probably felt, as being so young, because at 12 and 7, you don't really understand things the way that you should. Like, you have a very narrow mindset, and sometimes you blame yourselves for things that are definitely not your fault as a child. And then sometimes that belief follows into adulthood because it's already been established for you. But the girls might have felt guilt for asking to live with their father during that time, because it meant that they didn't get that time with their mother, and they might have felt bad for her sadness. Children often feel responsible for their parents' emotions, so I'm sure that was an unfortunate thing that those girls had to live with for so long.
Yeah, I agree. You know, but Sandra wanted to see her kids happy, and if that's what they wanted, then, you know, obviously she was going to oblige. So I don't know. But I would assume that any child, after something like this happens to your mom, you're gonna feel that way.
Right. And it is a testament to how good of a parent she was, because, as every parent should, she put her child's need or her children's needs before her own. Before the detectives could even finish the case file, they were paid a visit by their commander. He told them that he had heard that they were working on an old homicide case at 1165 3rd Street. He asked when their victim had gone missing, and they told him that it was in December of 1982. He smirked and nodded his head, and then went on to tell them a story that was equal parts sad and shocking, and would potentially help them solve their case. Because what would be the chances that two murders occurred on the same property and weren't connected?
Excuse you? What do you have in store for us?
Just 4 months after their victim had gone missing, so that would be March, April of 1983, a woman had been reported missing by her family in Pebble Beach, which is a town very near to Monterey. According to that case file, Suzanne Nixon was a 30-year-old hairdresser that lived with her parents and siblings. The family was a tight unit, and they knew right away that something was wrong when Suzanne did not return home from a night out with friends. Suzanne was a beautiful woman who had earned her associate's arts degree from a nearby college. The Nixon family had moved to California later, as Suzanne had been born in Nebraska on January 17, 1953. Although they had not been lifelong residents, her family had made a name for themselves in the community. Her mother had even run for Congress. Her loved ones said she was everything you could hope for in a friend, sibling, or daughter. She was outgoing and friendly, and cared deeply about those both in her life and strangers just passing by. On March 3rd, 1983, she had told her family that she was just headed out to get some pizza, which was why her parents were concerned when she had not come home that night. It wasn't like she had gone out to go partying and may have stayed the night with a friend. After all, she was 30 years old. It was only supposed to have been a bite of pizza. After waiting hours and hours, Suzanne's mother called her eldest daughter, Diane, who was living outside the house on her own, and told her that Suzanne was missing. Distraught and agreeing with her mother that she would never do that, Diane told her mother that she should call the police. The first thing the detectives working Suzanne's missing persons case did was retrace her steps. And in order to do that, they had to start where she did, at the pizza place she had gone to with her friends. They spoke to the friends that Suzanne's parents had known to be there that night. They said that Suzanne had spent most of her time at the restaurant with her boyfriend. Well, her friends clarified that this guy was not necessarily her boyfriend. that they were very off and on, but at the moment they seemed to be on, and they were very close all evening. When it came time to leave, they said the couple had left together. When asked if they had been fighting or seemed to not be happy with each other, the friend said no. Everything seemed to be fine. They asked what the man's name was and where he lived, and they told the detectives that his name was Alfred Powell, and he lived in a detached garage in the backyard of a bungalow property in Monterey.
Is this the same bungalow property that we have been referencing?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
The detectives needed to speak with Powell, but he lived in a different town. So they reached out to the Monterey County Sheriff's Department to assist them in the investigation, so there would be less jurisdictional issues to deal with between the different locations, especially if this lead turned out to be helpful. The deputy from the county sheriff's department that had been assigned to go to the residence of Alfred Powell was the commander the detectives that we know from 2015 were talking to.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's why he's like, oh, I know that residence. And let me tell you about my encounter there.
Really?
Yeah, because he said that it was the most memorable interview of his career, which was why he never forgot the address in all the decades that had passed. So when he saw it cross his desk again, he rushed to tell them about it. So the commander, 33 years prior, and his partner were given the information that this Powell guy was the on-again, off-again boyfriend of a missing woman. And he was apparently a smooth talker and lived in the detached garage of an elderly woman's home. He had befriended her and somehow worked out a deal that he could live in the garage rent-free and he would take care of her yard work.
Oh, okay, okay.
And other odds and ends that she may need. Not a bad arrangement to live rent-free in the beautiful suburb of Monterey, but it could be seen as a little griftery. On the night of March 4th, 1983, not even 24 hours since Suzanne Nixon had gone missing, the deputy got out of his sheriff's office issued vehicle and walked towards the house with his partner. The same coastal wind that would accompany a young landscaper 33 years later when he discovered the body of Sandra Steppen pushed against his back as he walked towards the beach bungalow. They were just 4 blocks from the Del Monte beach access. The area was a hotspot for locals and the place to go if you wanted to avoid the locations of tourists. So it was a great location to own a home in, which was why later on, this was like a very expensive neighborhood in 2015. To the left of the house was a single car driveway. And if you followed it straight back, you'd see a tall fence. And behind that tall fence was a detached garage. The fence had a lock, but that night it was open. The fence had a lock, but that night it was open. The deputy proceeded back into the yard and saw that to the left of the yard there was a large L-shaped detached garage that was approximately 25 by 11 feet. He knew the man that he was looking for lived there, but he didn't see a light on within the garage. There was a side door, so he knocked on it. Now, there were a lot of things wrong with the situation. Letting someone live in an unfinished garage that was not zoned for occupancy, whether they were living there for free or not, was illegal. So he was prepared to use that information if the man wasn't helpful.
Okay.
But the deputy was shocked by several things when a man from within the garage opened the door and greeted them. First, he invited the two men in, and he couldn't have been more friendly or disarming. Secondly, it was the state of the garage. When he had heard the man was living there, he thought there would be a bed, some things that he probably set up for himself, like he thought he'd have a decent hookup, But this was not the case. It was just a garage filled with a lot of junk, with no running water or electricity.
That's strange.
It was actually kind of shocking to see that someone lived like that. And it reminded him of the transient kind of homeless population that Monterey had in excess at the time that usually lived on the beach. So he's thinking that, you know, at least this man's thinking, I'm not exposed to the elements. But his opinion teetered on the man as he spoke because he was very charming. On one hand, he was well-spoken and was answering all the questions that they had about Suzanne. But on the other hand, to live like this and not have the money to pay for a better place to live after so many months of staying there for free made him think that he was one of the grifters that they were dealing with in the beach community of Monterey County, which is something that, you know, they did deal with a lot, especially because they had people who would kind of take advantage of people who had vacation homes and would stay there for free, but then not take care of the property. So it was giving him those vibes again. So although he was like, oh, I'm glad this guy's being helpful, his guard was up.
Right. And that's normal, especially since you're investigating something. You're obviously checking, you know, where the guy lives and everything. Your radar is just going to be buzzing the whole time.
100%. You also have to imagine there's like this other element here too that's adding this creep factor in. They're going to question Alfred Powell at nighttime because she was reported missing that day. It took them a while to talk to everybody. They found out she was with Alfred Powell. Then they had to find out where he lived. Then they had to get the county sheriffs to go there. So it's nighttime. There's also no lights within the garage. So they're surrounded in darkness with this suspect. On top of it, they don't know what to think of him. So that's just this extra element that they had there that was keeping them on guard. Powell told them that he had been with Suzanne the night before. They'd gone to a pizza parlor with friends of hers, but they really had been talking the entire time together. He really liked her. As Powell, who was a 27-year-old, good-looking African-American male who was short in stature with an average build, spoke with his partner, who was taking notes on all of his responses, the deputy couldn't help but wonder how this man looked so put together while living in this garage. He also thought he was being very helpful and wasn't nervous at all. And for all that he was saying about how much he liked Suzanne, he seemed to be not too worried about the fact that she was missing and the last person she was seen with was him.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like when these people get interviewed, it's almost like the red flag is the overconfidence that they are not going to be or not going to assume to be involved in any way. Like, they're just so confident, just, you know. They're
too calm, cool,
yeah,
collected.
Exactly, yeah.
But even though Powell wasn't nervous, the deputy sure was. All of his training had told him not to enter a dark dwelling. And there he was, with his partner, in a dark dwelling, with a suspect. They hadn't cleared the space or properly looked for Suzanne or anything anywhere, because the location was so dark, and they just hadn't expected it to be so unfinished. He just didn't like the situation, and he would reflect 33 years later that this was the first time in his career that his, like, everyone always talks about an intuition, right, when you're a police officer or a detective, and this was the first time it kind of, like, went off blaring for him. So as his partner asked questions, he was half listening, half alert to his surroundings. And he slowly shone his flashlight throughout the garage so he didn't miss any part of it. So while his partner was getting the statement, he was getting the lay of the land. As he did this, his partner asked Powell about that night. What had happened after he left the pizza place with Suzanne? He responded that she had offered to give him a ride home, which he had accepted. It was around 1:30 a.m. when she arrived out front with him in the car. They said their goodbyes, and he went into the backyard into the garage. He said that Suzanne had not come with him inside and that she drove away when he got onto the property, and that was the last time he had seen her. The conversation went on for a few minutes. The one deputy kept the small talk going because he noticed that his partner was scanning the space with the light from his flashlight. The mood was light. Powell was calm. But as soon as the roaming flashlight came to a halt, the entire atmosphere shifted. The deputy, who would later be a commander of the Violent Crimes Unit, had stopped his light on a clock radio. It was there because it sat in storage, clearly as it wasn't able to be used in a garage with no electricity. But that wasn't why he stopped his flashlight on it. On the radio was blood. Fresh, bright red blood. And a lot of it. He asked what was on the radio, which immediately stopped the conversation and directed their attention to the object. As he moved the flashlight over it, the wet liquid glistened and turned his stomach. Something didn't feel right. Suddenly, the casual atmosphere disappeared. Powell got noticeably uncomfortable, and the deputies shifted their stances. They were ready. For what, they didn't know, but they were. Powell broke the silence and said, "Oh, that was a raccoon that tried to get in through the garage." He then went into an incredibly detailed account about his struggle with the animal. Now, if you don't want to hear about violence against an animal, I would fast forward about 30 seconds. And I promise I'm not doing this just to arbitrarily add it. It is a very important detail, the story he tells. Powell said that he had seen the animal and smashed it in the head with the clock radio, which disoriented it. And then he grabbed the animal by its neck and strangled it. He then skinned and ate it.
Okay.
So this is his story.
That is extremely disturbing. But you know, if this person is the person that we are looking for the crimes, for the crime here, he could be referring. See, he's very quick with this. Mm-hmm. And people that are not seasoned or even having any like feeling, in their gut at all, would believe it because it happened so quickly that he was able to recover a story quickly.
Right.
But is he referring to the animal, right, as a person, right? Like, is he saying an animal, and it's easy for him to do that story because that's exactly what he did, but minus the animal, right?
Well, every good lie is based on a truth, isn't it?
Sure is, yeah.
This was quite the story. And not at all what the deputies expected. The deputy, who our 2015 detectives knew, said there was no way that the story Powell told about the raccoon could ever be true. If he would have tried to strangle a raccoon, disoriented or not, he would have had scratches all over his hands and arms. And there was nothing. He had the gut feeling, though, that Powell was able to tell the story with such ease and detail that it probably was true. Well, the attack part of it, anyway. The only thing that was different was that the victim probably wasn't a raccoon. It was probably their missing woman,
right,
Suzanne Nixon.
And him saying skinning and eating it was just because...
A shock factor.
Well, no, not even. He was waiting for the follow-up question of, okay, well, then where is the raccoon?
Oh, and to possibly explain any further blood on the property.
Correct. So he was kind of future-proofing his story.
Right.
So no further questions would be asked.
Well, Powell was arrested under suspicion of being involved with a missing persons case and brought in for further questioning. The clock radio was bagged as evidence. At the time, in early 1983, they wouldn't be able to test the blood for DNA. But they did have a test that could determine whether or not the blood present in the garage was from an animal or a human. At the station, Powell kept with his same story. But once they determined the blood on the clock radio belonged to a human, a warrant was signed for a search of the property. It did not take them long to find the body of Suzanne Nixon. She'd been wrapped in a green garbage bag.
Okay, well, there's a similarity there.
And tucked behind the tool shed. Investigators did not know what Powell intended to do with the body, because he had been interrupted during his concealment of the crime, as he had been questioned so quickly after Suzanne having been reported missing. What they did not know was that as they worked the crime scene, collecting all the clues they could, there was another victim beneath their feet that would stay hidden for another 32 years.
That is crazy. This feels, I have to tell you, this feels like a movie. I mean, I'm not trying to make light of this, but I'm being completely serious because it's almost so unbelievable that you would think it has to be some type of movie that you'd watch and not actual real life.
And the chances of everything happening, like their commander having been the deputy that was there that night. And it's almost like fate is stepping in and saying, these secrets have gone undiscovered for too long. And let's finally get justice here.
You know, I would have thought, though, I have to tell you, I mean, I know this is like they would never have thought this. And it's easy to say this now, you know, with knowing this information. I am aware of that, but I am just going to say it anyway. You would think that maybe they would say, if he was getting ready to bury this body, I wonder if he's done it before.
Well, they didn't know if he was getting ready to bury the body. He had only tucked it behind a tool shed.
I see what you're saying, because he could have went any route. He could have dumped it off somewhere. Right. He could have. I get what you're saying.
Because it had been less than 24 hours since she'd been reported missing. That's not to say there weren't mistakes made, and we will get there.
Okay.
An autopsy confirmed the gut feeling of the deputy. The story that Powell had told them about the animal most likely had happened to Suzanne. As it was reported that she suffered from blunt force trauma to the head, most likely caused by the clock radio, but her official cause of death had been strangulation. The Nixon family was absolutely devastated by the brutal attack on their daughter. And still, even after all of these years, they have not recovered from their loss. But I don't think you ever can. Because every event they have, every milestone they celebrate, every memory is one that they don't get to share with Suzanne. Throughout the investigation and the preparation for trial, Alfred Powell maintained his innocence, all the while presenting himself as an upstanding citizen who was caring and kind. But the evidence present in the case could not be ignored. In September of 1983, Alfred Powell was convicted of second-degree murder and was sentenced to 15 years to life in a non-jury trial. An awful detail of the case came from the testimony of a forensic expert who stated that Suzanne had suffered greatly, as the wounds she had were inflicted over a time frame of 30 minutes to an hour. So he's referring to the blunt force trauma that she suffered.
Okay. This man is a monster. If he is some kind of grifter, could he have done this in other places?
Right.
You know, not just here. I mean, we don't even know.
Local to the area.
Oh, he's right. But I mean, California is a big area. But
has he done it with more people?
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, the thing that I find most disturbing is that by all accounts of everyone present at the pizza place that night, they were having a fine time. Now, I know fights can happen out of nowhere, but everything seemed to be going well. They also were known to be a couple, so it wasn't like there was this denial of love or any rejection. I also think it's disturbing that he can't use the excuse of this was a crime of passion. I hit her over the head, then I got nervous, and I killed her. Which is horrific in and of itself, but he tortured his victim for a long amount of time. which showed that he was getting some gratification out of that. And that's highly disturbing. And now here they were 32 years later, and another body had been found on the same property. And Sandra's body had been found wrapped in a green plastic garbage bag as well. Had Powell killed Sandra 4 months before he killed Suzanne and buried her in the backyard? Had he planned to do the same thing with Suzanne? And that's a really important detail because, now, obviously because of double jeopardy, you can't be tried again for the same crime, but that's not second-degree murder, that's first-degree murder. Because that's planned out. If he did what he did to Sandra, enjoyed it, got away with it, buried her on the property, and then he thought to himself, I'm going to do the same thing with Suzanne.
Yeah, I mean, most likely, I think that's what his plan was to bury her just like he did
Sandra,
yeah. So, like, I feel like that's, we know that that's probably what was going to happen.
Right.
But it's interesting because he's using his, like, his outgoing nature to grab these women. Because very early on in the episode, when you said that she was dressed to the nines, Sandra, you know, like, that's an indication that, like, you know, planning went into that. You know, hey, I'm going to take you out on a date maybe or something like that.
Well, we're actually going to get into the whole scenario.
Oh, okay,
great. Of how Sandra met Alfred Powell.
Gotcha.
Which is going to be disappointing when it comes to the police department. Because as of right now, we're like, wow, great job. You even got the dental records. Everything's going phenomenally. But there were some actions that were missed back in 1982 that might have prevented the death of Suzanne, I believe. Now, another thing that Alfred Powell is taking advantage of is the fact that it wouldn't have been odd for the homeowner to think it weird that Powell was digging in her backyard because he was doing landscaping work for her. And the location in which they had dug up Sandra's body was only feet from where Suzanne's body had been found behind the shed. So what are the chances that two different men killed two different women, disposed of their bodies the same way, all on the same property? Slim to none. So this would make their cold case easy to solve. It had to have been Powell. But now they just have to prove it. After hearing this information, the detectives tracked down Alfred Powell. He was still in jail for Suzanne's murder. It turned out a parole board had not found Powell rehabilitated from the murder he committed. And that's because he was still denying that he had done it. Oh, and because when the parole board asked him about his feelings towards women, he stated that they were only there for his sexual desires. Yeah, that's not going to get you anywhere, buddy.
No.
And to think that is one thing, and then to say that aloud is another, and then also to say it to a parole board is another as well. But just as quickly, the detectives were relieved to learn that the person they suspected of Sandra's murder was behind bars. But they realized that might not be the case for long, because a program had been approved by the state of California back in 2014 that was only finally being implemented in 2015 as a reaction to overcrowding in the prisons of California. And this is called the California Elderly Parole Program, which stated that as long as you were not convicted of first-degree murder, which you should have been, they just didn't know, you were 60 years or older, and you had served at least 25 years in prison, then you could receive another parole hearing automatically. Now, that doesn't mean you automatically get released, but you get another hearing, even though you might not be up for one. And guess what? Powell had only been convicted of second-degree murder and had served more than 25 years in prison, and in 2016, he would be 60. They were only 3 months away from 2016. So if the detectives wanted to keep this man behind bars and make him serve his time for the murder of Sandra, and if they wanted to ensure no one else would be hurt, they needed to act quickly.
Yeah, I don't agree with a program like that, and I don't want to get political, but I'm just going to say, I mean, if somebody's 60 years old, that really doesn't mean anything. There's very capable, like physically capable people at 60 years old.
Oh, yeah.
If, you know, think about what he did. He will use his charm and just change his method based on his maybe physical, you know.
Well, now he's more disarming.
Yeah, it's even worse. But I'm saying because he doesn't have maybe this physical stature at 60, he will use more cunning technique to lure a victim and do it again.
Right, right.
So, like, I am not for that at all.
It's interesting. And I think that on a case-by-case basis, that it is something that is good because, yeah, it is an interesting thing to get approved. Now, what I like about it is that it doesn't mean automatic release. It just means that a parole hearing is called.
I know what you mean, but I just feel like if someone is in there for murder, especially, well, because we know it was calculated. You know what I'm right. saying? It's a little different here.
So you're thinking like, okay, I would like this, but I just don't want murder to be involved. Like maybe if it was a drug charge or a theft. Or
100%. Murder, right? I think murder is just the worst thing, obviously, that you can do. And it shouldn't be downplayed in any capacity.
Right.
You know, you're robbing somebody of life, and I don't think that that's fair. You shouldn't be given an opportunity to now walk out.
And obviously, you're thinking beyond that of like, okay, some people are falsely accused and falsely imprisoned. You mean the people that did it?
Yeah, like the ones where like, we know.
I'm just clarifying for you because I can foresee comments being made.
And I know. No, you're right, and I should clear it up. I'm just saying if we know for a fact that there's evidence to prove it, there's a paper trail, we know that he's dead to rights, so to speak.
You got to serve your time.
You should be serving your time, and there shouldn't be
so is that family, and it's not going to end.
Exactly. They're living with a life sentence except just not being in prison. I don't know. That's just how I feel about it. Like, I would even go as far as to say that even like if it's murder and it, but well, however they, I don't know. I'm not good with this stuff, but if it was like accidental death,
like manslaughter,
like, yeah, like that, that's, I think is a little, I mean, still is terrible, but maybe that would be allowed to be, you know, in with that program. But if you planned a murder, you went through the steps, it's premeditated, you do it. I don't know if you get that. That's not fair.
Right. Well, now they're really like in a bind, like their investigation, although everything has gone really smoothly for them in 2015, because they've gotten a lot of information very quickly. They need to act even quicker now because they need to hold him responsible for this death before he gets in front of a parole board. So going back to the case file and the information that Sandra's family had provided throughout the years, and in their interviews, the detectives continued to look for connections between her and Alfred Powell. The saddest part of Sandra's disappearance was that the detectives had learned that her daughters had always been really confused by their mother having gone missing. As children, they weren't really able to comprehend what had happened, and they carried into their adulthood this confusion. And although their rational adult brains knew that something terrible must have befallen their mother to keep her away from them, the small children inside of them worried that their mother had left them or that she had been upset about the changing in the custody agreement. Now, the investigators just had so much riding on finding this connection to Powell. They needed justice for Sandra. And to get answers for all of Powell's victims, to keep Powell in jail and prevent him from harming another woman. Because although he was 60, like you said, he's still very capable. And they wanted to get answers for Sandra's children. They've always had this question mark as to what happened to their mother, and they have found her body, but now they need to know what happened. In the file, they pored over every detail, trying to find their connection. So they went through everything they had, slowly, just like their commander had tracked the entirety of the garage with his flashlight. They would do the same with the massive case file of one of the county's oldest missing persons cases, now their homicide case. Luckily, the detectives that had worked Sandra's case kept meticulous records and wrote in length about everything they thought and everything their witnesses told them. Sandra had last been seen on Thursday, December 9th, 1982. The plan was for Sandra and her roommates to go out to a club and have a few drinks and dance to enjoy the holiday season that they were in the midst of. Sandra had borrowed a car from one of her friends so she and her roommates could go out. And as she was returning home with the vehicle to go pick them up so they could go out, which explains why she was wearing this red dress, she spotted a hitchhiker.
No. Oh.
The man told her where he needed to go, but Sandra told him that she wanted to take him there, but before she did that, he would have to come with her to make a few stops. The man agreed and got into the vehicle. Now remember, we're not talking about some scary hitchhiker on the side of the road that looks like he hadn't showered in 3 months. By all accounts, Alfred Powell is a very good-looking man. He's very well-dressed. He's very well put together. He speaks well. So I could see why she was disarmed by him a little bit. Now, the first place she went was back to her house in Seaside, which is close to Monterey, just north of the peninsula. She didn't want to leave the man in her car, so she invited him in. Sandra's roommates knew that she loved helping others, but they had both thought that she had gone too far in this case. The man they had sitting in their living room made them feel really uneasy. They described him as being an African-American male that was on the shorter side. He was bow-legged when he walked, and this is also a feature that Alfred Powell had. But they said the one thing that they couldn't get out of their heads was that although he was a good-looking guy, his eyes were empty, like they were dead. And that was something that they reiterated even 33 years later.
It's very interesting, right? How, like, that's a feature that seems to always be the trend
right
when we deal with people like this. And I think it's just such a weird detail that I always find, you know,
fascinating.
Fascinating, yeah.
Because he had a plan already.
Right. And then you're, those eyes are just so dead because you're thinking about what you're about to do and it's the worst thing that you can do.
Right. Now, I think it's interesting that he still did it, even though he went to her home and met her two roommates.
Yeah, right? That's kind of ballsy. Yeah. Jinx.
So Sandra had come home to change and to pick up the other two women. As she put on her outfit for the night, Sandra's roommate sat in the living room with the hitchhiker, trying to make awkward small talk. Sandra eventually came out, beautiful as ever, proud and excited about the night of fun that she believed they had ahead of them. She was still young and single, and she was in need of some fun. The confidence radiated off of her in the red dress and black blazer she had on. The outfit, minus the blazer, she would be found in almost 33 years later. But as Sandra buzzed around the living room, her roommates remained on the couch. They told her they were tired, and that because so much time had passed with her getting ready, that they just didn't want to go out anymore. They were going to stay in. Sandra did not let that hold her up. She told them that she still intended to go out, and that she would drop off the hitchhiker and then go to the club. The three women exchanged their goodbyes, and then Sandra and the hitchhiker left. Although that would be the last time the roommates saw Sandra, they would not be the last ones to see her alive. According to the report, the detectives had found that Sandra and the hitchhiker stopped for gas. This was at the Quick Stop on Fremont Street in Monterey, which is close to 3rd Street, only about 7 blocks away, running adjacent to it. Sandra was seen in her red dress buying gas inside while a man remained beside the vehicle the entire time. The detail of the hitchhiker really stood out to the detectives because the description given of him by the roommates really seemed to have described Powell, and so did these at the gas station. They questioned Sandra's roommates and the witness from the gas station in 2016. And though just about 33 years had passed, all three of them separately identified the person that was with her that night to be Alfred Powell. His photograph had been picked out of a lineup. So I just think that this is hard because at first you think Sandra's disappearance was just like she'd gone out, she never came home. What happened? She was with a very highly suspicious hitchhiker. Why was that lead not investigated further in 1982?
That is a really good question, especially since we have multiple people as witnesses to her being with him and everything.
Right. Like, let's ask around town. It seems like if that lead had been followed harder, then 4 months later, Suzanne Nixon would have never been murdered. So that's the one, like, I feel like the police did a great job and thorough investigation throughout both cases. But that's my one point of contention, is that I feel like they just really should have pursued this hitchhiker a little bit further.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that is a fumble on their part, which, you know, when you really think about it, like you said, you know, that could have stopped other people from being murdered, you know, if they would have investigated that properly.
And like you said, people hurt along the way because we don't know if other victims exist.
It's true.
Now, when the detectives, and now we're back in 2016, went to question Powell about the case in prison, he refused to speak with them. So at that point in the investigation, they had witnesses tying Powell to Sandra that night. But that was 33 years after the fact. They had a lot of circumstantial evidence, a lot of similarities, but what they were lacking was the ability to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it had been Powell. And they knew the defense team would tear apart all of their evidence and say too much time had passed for memories to be reliable. So to make the jury see that there had been a pattern present in Powell's life for a long time, a pattern of predatory behavior, but that in December of 1982, he escalated and then did so again a few months later in 1983, once he got a taste for it, and that given the chance, there was a possibility that he would do it again if released. So to prove this, the detectives and investigators with the district attorney's office began to dig into the past of Alfred Powell. They found exactly what they were looking for. A history of predatory behavior. There were two women that had made rape allegations against him. In both of those cases, Powell denied that he had raped the women and that rather the sex had been consensual. In both cases, there was no physical evidence that a rape had occurred and the charges were dismissed. In the end, it had come down to a he said, she said, and the women that had accused Powell were not what society would have deemed credible back in the late 1970s, as they had a past with prostitution and mental health and substance abuse issues. And on top of that, as the detectives learned later through the Suzanne Nixon case, Powell was a smooth talker. If they would not have found the blood on the clock radio, they probably would have deemed his account credible when he said she just dropped him off and left.
Right, because they really don't have any evidence other than the clock with the blood on it initially.
Right.
You know, so yeah, I mean, that's kind of true.
The only thing that they had on their side was time, that he didn't have enough time to clean everything up.
Right.
Or light. The investigators in 2016 theorized that Alfred Powell had probably victimized more women in the 1970s and 80s than just the two that came forward, because they knew the truth about statistics and women reporting sexual assaults. If he had done this to women who were more vulnerable and who he knew wouldn't be believed, like those involved in prostitution or those who had substance abuse or mental health issues, then there might be more out there. They put out a statement that explained their case and the fact that they were seeking out other women that had suffered any violence at the hands of Powell, or really, just any information anyone had. And when they did so, they almost immediately received a call from a woman that stated that Powell had attacked her. And she remembered every detail of that night. She said that her brother was having a party at his home and that it had quickly gotten out of control, that people were showing up out of nowhere, and that he didn't know half of them. One of those party crashers was Alfred Powell. At some point in the night, she was ready to leave, so she began her walk home. Powell left right after she did, and as she started her walk down the dark suburban street, she noticed that he was walking behind her. She started to walk faster. He kept pace with her. She tried to ignore it, thought it was nothing. But then he began to sprint towards her, and there was nothing she could do. Nowhere to run. And he jumped on top of her. She was down on the ground and he had his hands around her neck. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
She was shocked. She didn't know who he was or why he was doing this to her. She wanted to scream for help, but she couldn't. She remembered thinking that she was going to die and there was nothing she could do about it. That she was powerless as she gasped for any bit of air that she could. The attack must have caused a commotion because it attracted the attention of other people who were walking in the area. They looked over some shrubbery and found a man strangling a woman to death. They yelled that they were going to call the police and sprinted back inside towards their own home to call 911 because this is before cell phones. Now, this was the strangest thing, the woman said. As soon as Powell heard the person was going to call the police, he stopped strangling her and laid down on the grass beside her and pretended to fall asleep.
Oh, this guy's out of his mind.
When officers arrived, Powell was still pretending to sleep, while the victim stood up nearby, unsure of what to do. Like, she was almost shocked. She was holding on to her neck, which was very tender, she said, and she appreciated every ragged breath she could take. They asked her what happened, and she explained that he just attacked her out of nowhere and that he was going to kill her. When they asked Powell what happened, he said he had no clue, that he had just been sleeping outside after having one too many at the party, and she freaked out on him. So basically, she was falsely accusing him. The victim said she was ashamed of what happened. And she, like many other women, felt what happened was her fault. So she chose not to press charges because she had been embarrassed by the attack. She never even told her family about it. She just walked away happy to be alive. The date of this attack was just days before the disappearance of Sandra.
Wow. Yeah, see, that's what I'm saying. This guy has definitely done things like this before.
In the neighborhood.
Right. Even if it was an unsuccessful, to his ultimate goal, he still was doing things like this around the neighborhood and around the area.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean, just because he didn't wind up killing somebody, doesn't mean, like, look at this. Still inflicted pain and suffering to whoever was his next target.
But he would have killed her if those people didn't show up.
That's true. That is true.
The investigators were in awe of what they had heard and were reading. The man was a danger to society if they had ever seen one. He most likely had multiple victims out there that had never come forward. And for all they knew, he could have killed other women as well. Hearing about the sexual element of his attacks resonated with them, because both Sandra and Suzanne's bodies had been found in the exact way. With a green garbage bag over their heads and upper torso area, and their clothing pulled up, and they were naked from the waist down. He had also been trying to do this with the woman. He would strangle the women to death, and then he would sexually assault them. Now, that's something that couldn't be proven in Sandra's case, and in Suzanne's case, This is what's difficult, right? Because this, if this attack happened post-mortem the way it did, it could have looked like she just had consensual intercourse. And sometimes rape can look like that through exams. Like, there could be no evidence of a violent attack. And that would never be able to be determined in those two victims. But that was most likely what he had planned to do with this woman, if his MO is correct. They assume that Sandra had met the fate that had been intended for this woman, all because she was just being nice to him, because that's the kind of woman that Sandra was. But because this had been a failed attempt, but he had wanted to do it, was why it happened to Sandra. Like, he needed to get his fix. And that's why a few days later, this happened. Now, this is also kind of terrifying, because this doesn't seem like the actions of a man who this is his first time.
Right. That's what I mean. That's the feeling I get from this, based on everything that you've, you know, communicated to us. I just don't think that this is his first time. No way. No. No way.
And in knowing this, the theory that they worked up was that Powell operated in two ways. He was a sexual predator who was intelligent. And he knew that if he attacked a woman who wouldn't be believed, he could do what he wanted with her, and had. And he was right. They'd not been believed. And that's the unfortunate part of this all. However, if he wanted to assault someone who was in quote unquote good standing with the community, he would have to kill them first, because they would tell. And that was why what had happened to that party goer happened, and why what happened to Sandra and Suzanne happened. Powell had escalated, but luckily they had stopped him when they did, but not before two women lost their lives. The investigators and prosecutors were very happy that they were establishing a pattern of predatory behavior that would allow for the past of Powell to be on display in the courtroom. Powell had been smart in the Nixon trial to present his case to a judge and not an emotional jury. This time, he would be seen for the predator he was, who only stopped because he had been caught, and luckily early, because he could have become a serial killer and might be one. He even said as much to a parole board, right? Women were only present to fulfill his sexual desires. This is not a man reformed by his prison time, only hardened and made more determined by it. The evidence, though, was circumstantial, but the connection between the murder of Sandra and Suzanne was undeniable. They had been left in the same physical way. Their cars were both abandoned in high traffic parking lots in Monterey, with their keys left in the ignition, the cars completely wiped of prints, found on the same property, same cause of death, same clothing pieces missing, and their tops pulled up. Same garbage bag over both of them. There was also another detail, a final act of aggression. Both women were placed face down. Maybe so he knew that they couldn't be looking at him from where they were. They'd been killed by the same man. There was no doubt of that. And they could establish a violent and cruel past of Powell. They knew they had him for the trial that was scheduled in 2018. Sandra's daughters said that when they heard their mother's murderer had been behind bars for all of those years, it didn't make them feel better the way that they would have expected it to, but rather they still just wanted justice for their mother. And then they came to the realization that no outcome would ever make them whole, because they were still missing the woman who had made them. All of this was presented during the discovery phase of the trial, before juries were present. It was then that Powell knew how strong the case against him was. And it was then that he lost that calm, cool composure he wore like armor. The prosecutor said that he was furious and whispered wildly to his attorney. On January 2, 2018, just 3 days before the trial was set to begin, the prosecution received a call from the defense that they didn't want to go to trial and would be willing to take a plea deal. They stated that Powell was willing to admit what he did if he received a second-degree murder charge. The deal was accepted, and Alfred Powell was sentenced to 15 years to life in addition to the sentence he was serving. The positive was that he would never leave prison and never be able to sexually assault or strangle another woman. But unfortunately, we will never know the true depths of his depravity or the amount of victims he truly has. Sandra's daughters were happy about the outcome and believed it allowed them to fully process what had happened to their mother and them now that they had answers. The remains had to be preserved for the trial, but once the plea deal came through and Powell was sentenced, Sandra's remains were released to her family. Finally, after 35 years of secrets and concealments, Sandra's family was able to say goodbye to her and lay her to rest on January 17th, 2018, which just so happened to be the birthday of Suzanne Nixon, who would have been 66 years old. Just another connection that the two women had.
That's crazy and so sad. You know, it's like, it's, you just hate to see it because, you know, some of this could have been avoided, but the countless others that could be out there, and then all the families that were worried about where their family member or mother, you know, where they were for all this time.
And might possibly blame themselves for it.
Yeah, like, it's so sad, and it really ravages, like, everyone involved. I hate it. You know, it's so sad.
It's disturbing.
It's disturbing, and it makes you feel like a certain way. Like, you just almost don't even have the words for, you know, because you start, you know, I'm not trying to say I'm like some sort of empath or anything, but, you know, I just feel like you almost feel like when you try to put yourself as close as you can to it, you know, you feel a certain way, and right. you almost get the feeling like of what they must be enduring, you know, for all that time.
Sad, but it's good that she was recovered, and it was almost like she was waiting to just be unearthed because she had all the information they needed.
That is
to
wild.
Identify her.
Yes, everything, the picture, the pocketbook, the, you know, calendar. Everything, the calendar. Oh my God.
Well, guys, we're very interested to hear what you have to say about this case, because this one was truly fascinating and poetic almost in a way. But before we go, what I want to say is thank you to our newest supporters on Patreon. So thank you to Darian Smith, April Huey, Tamika C., Danelle, Grace, Mars Bars, Stacey Lucian, Lisa M. Peter, Michelle Pfeiffer, Gerardo Martinez, Melissa, Nina Smith, Hey Sarah Licious, Rena Sano, Summer Brown, Marjorie Keeney, Nicola Ann Marie, Natalie, Janessa Vasquez, Nina Miller, Mildy, Sarah, Reedy, Sarika Suvrendranathan, Elijah Bean, Sarah, Haley, Amanda Wright, Kaylin Pendry, Dana Lee, Tracy Wisenhunt, Christian Hawk, Julianne Ford, Kim Stover, Angie, Kelly Squires, Trisha Kusher, Ellen Haynes Chaponis, Sophie, Jay Zuniga, Melissa Bromwell, Abarita, Kristen Houston, and Morgan. We hope you guys are enjoying all of those extra episodes. All right, guys. Until next time, don't park next to Vans.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Hey, let's talk about something a lot of us deal with, thinning hair or hair loss. If that sounds familiar, CAPS has solutions. Their hair restoration treatments are personalized, designed to strengthen your existing hair, encourage regrowth, and improve scalp health. The providers at CAPS guide you every step of the way with advanced treatments for noticeable, long-lasting results. And when you book your first hair restoration appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Think about it. When it comes to your own food, you can walk into a restaurant, see what's being made, and know exactly what you're getting. But with dog food, most brands keep that completely hidden. Just Food for Dogs does the opposite. They've built their entire brand around open kitchens. You can actually walk in and watch them prepare your dog's meals with real human-grade ingredients like chicken, beef, carrots, and peas, cooked right there in front of you. No mystery, no behind the scenes you're not allowed to see. That kind of transparency is rare in the pet food world. And it's a big reason they've become the number one vet-recommended fresh dog food, earning trust from pet parents who want to feel confident in what they're feeding. When a brand is willing to show you exactly how your dog's food is made, it says a lot about the care, quality, and standards behind every meal they produce. Nothing to hide, everything to love. Go to justfoodfordogs.com and get 50% off your first order.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.